Welcome to Media Path. I'm Fritz Coleman.
And I'm Louise Palenker.
Today we have two fantastic guests. First, the esteemed Congresswoman from Texas 30th Congressional District, who is fighting the good fight in that bloody war zone known as Congress. She's Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, an honor to have a chance to talk to her. And we're also going to have a man who's hosted talk shows and game shows, done stand-up comedy, a funny and charismatic dude. Michael Berger will be with us in a few minutes. But first, Weezy, what do you have this week?
First, I've been watching television.
I know you have.
So I watched The Synanon Fix on HBO. It's on the HBO. You can find it streaming. Synanon, I don't know if you've heard that word before, but Synanon was an organization devised by a Chuck Diedrich in 1958 as a rehab option for heroin addicts when barely any existed. A mastermind in the organization and the harnessing of humans. Chuck quickly grew an interwoven network of farms and businesses built around the concept of communal living. The seemingly ideal setting attracted non-addicts known as lifestylers. And as his collection of devotees grew, Chuck's therapies and dictates became increasingly strange, extreme, and even dangerous. They included housing children on brutal off-site campuses, shaving heads, forcing marriage swaps, and a once peaceful culture ramped into encouraging aggression that escalated into terror and violence. The series brilliantly illustrates the dangers of authoritarianism. One person may have some good ideas, some strengths, some courage, some wisdom, but whatever the level of charisma, or especially when that person exudes enormous charm and pull, ultimate control will spell doom for everyone. For filmmaker Rory Kennedy, this guy's vanity led to a tremendous amount of footage for the doc. Film, recordings, video, and audio tape. Chuck was confident that whatever he had to say was worthy of being preserved. Power should be checked, especially where the powerful are charismatic. Not every leader remains benevolent. That's because power does not corrupt, it reveals. Great leaders understand balance. George Washington stepped down. Bill W. would not go on the cover of Time magazine. America and Alcoholics Anonymous are not about a personality. They are sets of ideals, guiding principles that work because the concepts remain after people move on. The four-part documentary series, The Synanon Fix, is directed and produced by Rory Kennedy, and you will find it on HBO.
I can't wait to see this thing.
Yes, it's
another reason to buy another streaming service. I don't have Max yet, but I will have.
There's a lot of good going on the Max.
No, I know. You said the best documentaries. And I love Rory's work. I think she did the quintessential documentary about Vietnam called The Last Days of Saigon, which was breathtaking. It was so perfect.
She's done a few. She did one about her mom, Ethel. It's extraordinary. I recommend that.
All right. My pick today is a series, A Gentleman in Moscow. It's an 8-part series on Amazon Prime. Only 4 parts have aired, but it's so good. And I was so excited to tell you about it. I thought I'd do it before it concluded. A Gentleman in Moscow is a best-selling novel written in 2016 by Arthur Amor Towles. It's set in 1922, right after the Russian Revolution. The Russian aristocracy had to be forced out and sometimes killed and replaced by communism. This is a fictional story about Count Alexander Rostin, who was stripped of his title and all of his property and forced into a house arrest for the rest of his life at the Metropole Hotel in Moscow, which incidentally is a real place that still exists. The Count is a resilient, stiff upper lip character, not easily shaken, and a very sharp wit. He admittedly has never worked a day in his life. This story watches him go from a person of privilege, whose whole identity was his royal station and wealth, to someone who realizes that true success comes from emotional awareness and warm friendships. The Count is played masterfully by Ewan McGregor. His real-life wife, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, plays a saucy and sexy Anna Urbanova. The sweetest and most heartbreaking relationship in this story is between the Count and a very young preteen girl, Nina Kulikova, played by Alexa Goodall. She and her father are residents of the hotel. She becomes a buddy and a co-conspirator of the Count's as he spins tales of elegant aristocrats for her, and they have adventures in the dark corners of the hotel. It is a gorgeous story, beautifully photographed, and I loved it so much I just started reading the book, and the book's even better. He's even charming and more funny in the book.
The book is sensational. I read it in 2016 or whenever it came out, and I absolutely adore watching the hotel come to life.
Oh.
in
Wait
the film.
To see how it's photographed. You're just going to love
yeah,
it.
I've seen a couple episodes.
Oh, I didn't know. Okay,
yes, so yeah. I'm completely thrilled. You will be too. Watch one, read the other, do both. It's pick and choose your adventure. It's quite a tale, and it's really about how when the whole world disappears and you're...
Hey, sorry to interrupt, but we got Jasmine.
Okay.
In the waiting room. Shall I admit her?
Yep.
Yes.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes. We sure can. Amazing. Congresswoman, we're so honored to have you on today. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett is a Democrat who represents the 30th District of Texas, including parts of Dallas and Tarrant counties. She became a lawyer to fight for the underserved in the area of civil and human rights. Before she went to Congress, she was a representative in the Texas State House, a fascinating and devoted public servant. And I have to say, every time she speaks on MSNBC, I can't not watch. I really enjoy her opinion about stuff. We're honored to have Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett. Welcome, Congresswoman.
Thank you so much.
All right, you started your career as a lawyer involved in the area of social justice, particularly among the underserved. And an example of your efforts now in that area is to make FAFSA more equitable. FAFSA is a hot button issue for me because one of my sons couldn't have gone to school without FAFSA aid. It's an important student aid program. Talk about what you're doing in that area.
Yeah. So first of all, it's great to see both of you. And FAFSA is important to me, too. As somebody who's still paying her student loans, I don't know that I'd be sitting in Congress, but for having access to that aid. And obviously, we are a diverse country. We are a melting pot. We are a country of immigrants. And what we're finding out is when they rolled out the new FAFSA, unfortunately, there were those who had parents or have parents that don't have Social Security numbers, and they were unable to actually apply to get their aid, which is absolutely ridiculous. Yep. Obviously, your parents may not have a social because they may not necessarily be full U.S. citizens, but if you were born here, you are a U.S. citizen, and you should not have any issues when you're trying to apply for something like FAFSA. So it's one of those things that we are working to fight against and make sure that we can correct. But it was really disappointing to find out that that recently happened to so many students.
Well, I want to go back in time a little bit because you are a bright light. One word used to describe you is fearless. And I'm wondering what you were like as a child, because it feels like even if your mom were not filming, you would have been that kid going, "Listen, Linda, I would like to present my case for receiving a cupcake."
I did talk a lot. I don't know that I argued a lot, but I was known for being a big mouth. My cousins did not want me to know what things they were up to because they were afraid that I was going to go and tell my granny on them, but not very much arguing. I was the type of kid that, if I felt like I was right, though, I was going to stand there on that. And I remember a time when I was in elementary and I got a grade and I felt like the teacher was wrong. It was elementary or junior high. And I was like, the teacher's wrong. And my mom was like, what? I was like, she's wrong. You know, like one thing I was very good at was math. And so I was like, there's no way that my grade came out to this based on everything that I know about all the tests that I've taken. And my mom trusted me and she stood with me and she went to the administration and they found out that the teacher had miscalculated my grade. So definitely whenever I feel like I'm right, I stand in it. But I wasn't very argumentative. And even now I wouldn't consider myself to be very argumentative. I consider myself to be standing on the side of right when I have to speak up.
Well, you have to be able to stand up for yourself because you represented the 100th district in the Texas House, which had to be a lonely job, being this one Democrat in the midst of the turmoil down there in the state of Texas. Please excuse me for judging your state, but it's been in the news a lot lately.
Valid judgment. Obviously, most people are very aware of my very radical and ridiculous and inhumane fear-mongering governor. So absolutely, the idea of getting any good legislation to his desk that he would pass into law didn't happen, for sure. But I'll tell you one thing. You know, being in the Texas State House and being in the minority in the House, knowing that we were in the minority in the Senate, knowing that we had this ridiculous governor, it prepared me for all the nonsense that I'm having to deal with now. At least I'm only in the minority in the House. So I walked in and I definitely knew what it was like to be in a very toxic environment, yet still needing to be a solid voice and representative for my district. And I feel like I've been able to do that mostly because I had to deal with the headache of being in the Texas House.
Yes, it's a proving ground, definitely, for sure. That's your, I don't want to call it boot camp, but it's probably as difficult as crawling under razor wire while while breathing, you know, toxic smoke,
absolutely,
tear gas.
My Republican colleagues want to talk about keeping D.C. streets crime-free. They can't even keep the halls of Congress crime-free, because we gonna talk about this, because I got 24 seconds. My freshman colleague has just been indicted on 13 felony counts, right? But have they exhibited any courage to say, you know what, we will disallow this in our body. We will make sure that we expel this individual. They have not. So what I don't want to hear is that they care about crime, because if they did, they would start by cleaning up our own house and mind our own business instead of coming after D.C. So thank you so much for your time.
But the we are watching currently, I don't know, it's like a slow motion, I guess, crumbling of the Republican Party. It seems to be cracking along, and correct me if I have this wrong, along Christian supremacy versus Putin's subservience lines, or is there some overlap there? You know, what are the camps?
There's definitely overlap there. And again, I don't know who their Jesus is, but it ain't mine, that's for sure. These so-called Christians who definitely are doing everything that they can to act very un-Christian-like, I'll say that. And yeah, they are imploding. I think what we see is that there's a definite MAGA crowd, and then there's the Republican crowd, and they're all trying to vote on the same ticket because that's the only way that they can win. But they aren't the same. They're nowhere near being the same. MAGA is all about tearing down government as it exists as a whole. They're just trying to tear it down from within. And the Republicans, the ones that I would consider to be traditional Republicans, they're actually running for the hills. Now, they've taken some of the terrible votes as well, but they are retiring. They are leaving office early. They are like, I want to get the hell out of here. And when you see the likes of a Ken Buck who says, hey, I'm out and I'm going to screw you on my way out. This is a Freedom Caucus guy. Like, this isn't like, you know, some guy that's like, oh, this is a middle of the road type guy. No. But it's literally, even though he's Freedom Caucus, he actually wanted to govern and he still believed in some of the basics of governance in general and of our institution. He didn't agree with the impeachments that had no foundation whatsoever. He thought that that was tearing down our institution. He finally said to hell with it after he was booted from his district office because he refused to vote for Jim Jordan, because he said, I refuse to vote for someone to be the Speaker of the House who refused to accept the election results. I won't do it. This is a Freedom Caucus guy, right?
Yeah.
And then you've got MAGA, which most of them are just idiots. I'm going to just be honest. Like, these are the people that rode the little bus. I hate to offend the people that rode the short bus, but seriously, these people, I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is have words for her level of, there are people that pretend and put on because they feel like that's what I've got to do so I can get on Fox News and, you know, hopefully I can raise lots of money and that kind of stuff. And then you have like people that are straight up idiots, like legitimately. I'm like,
well, you know, what happened last,
anyone in there?
What happened last Friday in Congress may have softened her volume a little bit. She may have had a little bit of a comeuppance last week because of what Speaker Johnson did, or no?
She doesn't have that blend of meds. No.
No, she doesn't. You're absolutely right. Like, it's not stopping her. Like, she just went on Fox or Newsmax, one of the two, like maybe a day or two ago, and she said, absolutely, when we get back, she's going to vacate the speaker.
So when you two cross paths in the hallways, is there a pleasantry exchanged, or what am I seeing?
No. No, yeah. We don't actually cross paths in the hall very often at all. I can't really remember passing her very much. I mean, everything in Congress is the left and the right. So when we're in the chamber, Democrats sit on the left, Republicans sit on the right. When we're in committee, Democrats sit on the left, Republicans sit on the right. We even enter on the left and the right. So we have our own entrances and everything. So it's not really the type of environment that encourages you to really work together.
So you're hanging around the halls waiting for Matt Gaetz to show up? Come on.
Not quite. Even though some would argue that I'm safe because I am not a teenager, but nevertheless.
So
coming hard.
One of the key cards that the Democrats will play in the election is going to be women's right to choose. And you and Congressman Dan Goldman have introduced the Abortion Care Awareness Act to give women access to accurate abortion information, which has never been more important. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So first of all, it's very confusing because when we lived in the world of Roe, that was the law of the land. The most that you may run into is that, there were different interpretations as to when someone may be able to have their abortion, like at what point. And so as of now, though, you've got states that can decide how long, they can decide if you can get it, they can decide under what circumstances, they can decide whether or not someone is going to be criminalized. You didn't have all of that before. And so with this patchwork of, women in Texas definitely don't have the same access and reproductive rights and autonomy over their body as, say, women in California or in New York. And so it can be confusing. And if you are stuck in a situation where you're trying to figure out, where can I go? Can I leave? We've got, people out there saying you can't leave your state. If you leave your state, you can be charged. There's just so much disinformation and misinformation. You also have these so-called pregnancy crisis centers that are nothing more than abortion bashing centers that are telling you that you're the devil if you're seeking an abortion. So when you're already in a traumatic situation and you just need accurate information, one thing that we should be able to do in the federal government is tell you, yes, you have no rights in the state of Texas, no rights in the state of Arizona, no rights in the state of Florida, but you can go to places like DC. You can go to places like New York. And also just kind of giving a red flag of, don't listen to this particular like crisis center because they're not a real crisis center. And just really just having it to where you can go to one place and get that information.
So this is a question on behalf of my cousin Rick, who is our studio audience today. He is wondering which issue will drive more voters to the polls, abortion rights or fears about our border?
Definitely abortion rights. Abortion rights, hands down. And I'll tell you why. Even when you look at the special election that we just had with Tom in New York.
Right.
Listen, he won. And I mean, we're talking about a huge swing in that district.
Yeah.
That they experienced. And this is at a point in which New York had become one of the epicenters of we're being invaded. We're mm-hmm. being invaded because my governor is shipping folk to New York. And so if he can swing that district in a state like New York that is experiencing kind of the firsthand effects of my governor doing his ridiculousness, then that tells me which issue wins out the day. Not to mention, it's not that Democrats are necessarily losing, so to speak, on immigration. We just don't do as well when we look at the polling on immigration. But honestly, the best gift that we probably could have had was Donald Trump himself. Mm-hmm. He made it clear after they worked to make sure that there could be legislation that would get passed, bipartisan legislation out the Senate that they did pass. It's sitting in the House and Donald Trump is the one that said, kill it.
Do Republicans hear that story, though, when all they watch is news from their own bubble?
But Republicans aren't going to be the ones that are going to vote for us anyway. So we don't care. Like, mm-hmm. that's not going to, you know, they've got whatever number people are going to show up because they're going to show up and vote for Donald Trump. What we care about is those independents. Mm-hmm. Independents are the ones that are going to determine what happens, as well as our own base, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why we've got to say, you know, honestly, I think the question is more so, will the war or abortion win out? Because when we're looking at our base, we are losing people in our base because of the war.
Right.
People are not enthusiastic about coming out. Okay. So my big question is, will our base show up for abortion, or will they stay home because of the war?
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting.
I think they show up because it's a peace of mind vote. If you're a childbearing age woman, it's not that you think of it once a week, not once a day. You think about it all day, every day. Every time you go to the bathroom, every time you fall in love, every time. I think when you and I had coffee together, I spoke about this with you. I think it's never off your mind, knowing that you do not have that right to even start your family safely, because if something were to go wrong, you would not be able to get the care that would save your uterus so that you could have another baby. It's just terrifying.
Yeah, I agree.
Let me ask you this. So Speaker Johnson was able to manipulate this vote, the four separate expenditures last week, and that really angered a good bit of the far right and sort of endeared him to part of the Democratic Party. Should Marjorie Taylor Greene decide to make a motion to vacate, would the Democrats be there to save him in the House, do you think?
I'm not saving him. I can tell you my vote is for Hakeem Jeffries.
Team Hakeem all day.
Yeah, you know, here's the deal. I've kind of been frustrated with my colleagues. I'm not even going to say kind of. I'm very frustrated with my colleagues. We have been so successful in the 118th. And when I say so successful, I mean, if you can find success in the 118th, the Democrats have been the ones that have found it, right? And we've been successful because we make sure that Hakeem has the power that he needs to negotiate. So I never, ever cut my leadership off at the knees. Mm-hmm. And so we are in our best position when it is clear that we are united, and we are united behind Hakeem. Mm-hmm. If the speaker wants to be saved, he has to go and talk to my leadership. Mm-hmm. And my leadership must be put into a position where he can negotiate for some kind of win. Mm. There are wins that the general public knows about, and then there are wins that the general public does not know about. And they have come at those times when whoever was speaker was really desperate and needed our help. And honestly, it's not hurting them as bad as it would hurt them if they had to try to deal with these nihilists who literally are never satisfied. It's never good enough. And I think that Speaker Johnson has realized, I will continue to spin my wheels and go nowhere, and they will still threaten my job and or take my job. Or I can build an alliance with the Democrats who understand that they're in the minority, so they're not going to ask for the world. But it's easier for me to give them whatever it is that they will accept than dealing with these people that are allegedly a part of my party. So my vote will always be no. There is only a one person majority. It doesn't take very many people. And Speaker Johnson needs to go and talk to Hakeem Jeffries. And Hakeem Jeffries can talk to those that are so ready and happy to help out a guy that tried to overturn our election. He can go talk to one of them, because there's plenty of them that are ready, and it only takes one.
Right. What are you eager to get done when we have a Democratic majority in the House and the Senate? What are you guys very eager to get done for America?
For me, it's repro. I don't know how far we can get, but it is a very scary world, especially being a Texan and a woman, and recognizing that 26,000 pregnancies were the result of rape alone just last year in my state, and that those women, I don't really care what decisions they want to make, but unfortunately, my state has disallowed them from being able to make a decision at all, which to me is a violation on top of a violation. They had someone who was criminally invading them and trespassing upon them and harming them. And then they had elected officials that decided to double down and compound that harm. And so I just don't know how I can be a Texan and a woman of color and not understand that this has to be one of those things that I go in guns blazing on. And then with that, coupled with that is access to the ballot box. So voting rights. We've got to make sure that we've got fair lines, we've got fair representation, and that people who actually do want to participate in the process are not impeding from participating. So for me, it's repro and democracy.
Mm-hmm. Has gerrymandering been a big deal in Texas like it has in other states?
Oh, yeah.
Gerrymandering.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because here recently in my oversight committee hearings just this past week, there was this argument that they kept making about how people that aren't U.S. citizens should not be counted in the census. And I was like, do y'all know what happened? Just FYI, Texas picked up two seats and New York lost one. So a big red state picked up two congressional seats and a big blue state lost one. So actually it's kind of been benefiting y'all, especially when we look at Florida as well, right? So here it is, they're like, they shouldn't count. But when we're looking at the resources that are needed in these states, they absolutely should count because they're still driving on our roads. They are still going to our schools. Like they are using our resources. So why would we not count people that aren't citizens in the census? But interestingly enough, the state of Texas over the last decade grew by 4 million people. Of those 4 million people, only 180,000 were Anglos. And guess what? You would think that would mean that we would get two new seats that would be for people of color. But we didn't, because they only wanted to use those bodies to get the seats. And then they completely gerrymandered and did what they wanted to do.
Let me ask you one more question, because I know you have to go save us from ourselves, and we're looking forward to that. What about the damage that the conservative Supreme Court has done to the Voting Rights Act? And how do we counter the disaster that turned out to be?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that we've got right now is to push, and tell people to vote, despite the obstacles that they may face. We've got to organize. We've got to educate. And we've got to mobilize. And I think that, you know, we do have some help from the Supreme Court, oddly enough, as well as these various state legislatures. I think that people that have never been engaged in politics before are deciding that they must get engaged, because if it's not repro access, then it's LGBTQIA rights. If it's not LGBTQIA rights, then it's affirmative action and diversity, equity and inclusion. And so, or student loan debt, right? Because we've had an administration that has tried to be aggressive and make sure that we can decrease this wealth gap that exists between Black folk and white folk, or just give people an opportunity once they get out of school to actually be able to build some sort of wealth. And so literally the Supreme Court has attacked everyone. And I think that that is the coalition that will win this for us and win the day. And I think that people hate the Supreme Court so much, whereas we used to just kind of look at them and not really pay very much attention. I think that there will be people that show up to the polls and they are absolutely going to vote specifically because they hate the Supreme Court. And right now there isn't a guarantee that Trump wouldn't have another appointee if he was to be sworn in as the president.
God help us. Well, it's going to be fun to watch you surge in Washington and become an even brighter light than you are now. It's such an honor for us to talk to you today, Congresswoman. We appreciate it.
Thank you for everything you do for all of us. We're so appreciative. And
thank you so much.
Go have a
great to talk to you. Thank you again.
Okay.
Have a good one.
Come back soon. Bye-bye.
Our next guest started as a stand-up on cruise ships. It's kind of an interesting story. And he went on to host a total of 4,000 hours of television. He hosted four game shows like Match Game, also talk shows like ABC's Mike and Maddie, and Home and Family with Christina Ferrari. Very funny and entertaining person. And he will be funny and entertaining in front of any gathering of more than two people. I've seen him do it.
We've got four people here. I think we qualify.
Michael Berger. Mike, it's good to see you, my friend.
Nice to see both of you. Louise, officially nice to meet you. And Fritz, what do I say about you?
Yeah, huh? There's not much you can say at this point.
You could go on and on. It won't be enough for him. He's very empty.
Yeah, well, our career started at about the same time. The only difference is yours continued, Fritz.
Mine included maps.
But you're
so fast and so funny. And I saw you recently at the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters, and you did a retrospective on game shows, which was not only hilarious, it was very interesting for those of us that don't know the history of it like you guys do. It was really funny.
Something I wanted to do as a kid, you know?
Yeah.
I thought game shows, talk shows, that's the niche, you know?
And here you are. But you have diversified. You're also very good at public speaking. You're good at coaching. You're good at flipping real estate. You're just that guy. So
it requires us to wear a few hats. I'll tell you, thank you, A, for the compliment. And it shows you how humbling the business is. I was in church a couple weeks ago, Catholic church, halfway through. And there's a husband and wife sitting in front of me. And it's 8 o'clock Mass. She's wearing a black dress, white pearls. Looks like Mrs. Kravitz, if you remember her from Bewitched.
Oh, she's a
little
favorite.
Overdressed for 8 a.m. Mass.
Yeah.
And the husband's just sat there beaten down for how many decades he'd been with her. And the priest says, turn to somebody and say, you know, peace be with you or whatever. She turns to me and says, turning around in the pew, what happened to you? Excuse me? Used to be on TV. Yeah, turn around. What do you say to that?
I get that all the time.
How do I explain the complexities of a 26-week pickup? You know, she goes, yeah, but the show you had. I go, turn around and listen to Papa.
But the show you had.
Well, you had a great start and kind of an odd, a left-handed start to your performance, which was on cruise ships. You hosted passenger talent shows, and that turned.
Well, I started out doing stand-up.
Yeah.
And one night the cruise director comes up to me and he says, hey, we have this passenger talent show. Could you host it? I have other things to do. And this was the 80s and he meant that as a verb. I said, well, what does that involve? He goes, well, they've signed up throughout the week. And then on Saturday night, we turn them loose in the main showroom. And at 11 p.m., check the rehearsal out and maybe put an order together that makes sense for a show. And these are just passengers. This is America's Got Talent before America's Got Talent. And I'm telling you, guys, the acts we saw, had an 85-year-old woman tap dance to the Lord's Prayer.
Mm. Perfect.
She came ready. So I did my stand-up, and then I jumped in and did this, and I said to myself, forgive the Oprah lift, this was my aha moment. I had more fun hosting. Where are you from? What are you doing? Turn them loose. So I went out, and I put $2,500 on my credit card, and I bought that two-piece video system you had to buy back in the day, which was the camera and the base unit. I lugged that on the ship with the tripod, set it in the back of the room, and pushed record and videotaped every passenger talent show they let me do. My first demo was nothing but 6 minutes of this stuff on cruise ships. And the audience is, you know, 1,000 people. They're half in the bag. They're fun.
Well, you're so fast and so good at that, and I'm sure that got you.
He's not done with his story.
I'm sorry. I'm paying him a compliment.
No,
you can stop for a compliment.
But that leads to the point, and that leads to you, because that tape got to the desk at NBC, and Fritz, you probably remember Brian Franz and Jake Talbert.
Absolutely.
So they were the heads of daytime.
Yeah.
And this tape gets to them through Mary Steck. Do you remember Mary Steck, the cue card gal?
Her. No.
I was doing, and I hate to brag, but I was doing warm-up on Dance Fever.
I want to talk all about warm-ups in a minute. But so that is okay.
Long story short, that gets to them. And these two guys are going, what is this show? What's going on here? Because it just raucous. And I said, the passenger talent show. And he goes, do you know why you're here? I said, yeah, Mary Steck was nice enough. And he goes, no, it's the clip of the guy you have at the very end of your demo. And it was an old guy who I think is old, which is not now. He grabs the mic out of my hand and says, you must be saying something very funny. I don't get it. And I let the guy have a moment. I mean, it was a huge laugh. The guys at NBC said, the reason you're sitting here is you let the guy have a moment. He goes, we can teach you how to host a game show. We can't teach you the instinct of letting somebody else be the star for a moment. Let them shine. And that's
I'm going to tell you a story that is exactly that, but it's a worst and it's a more traumatizing experience.
It's when he let me talk.
Okay.
Wait, what's that?
It was when he let me talk.
I'm not letting you talk.
It's not over.
I've got game show experience
okay,
here.
Okay, go ahead.
Jump in, Louise.
So when Wheel of Fortune was going to go syndicated, I auditioned for the job. I was not a huge watcher of game shows, so I didn't get the harmony involved in the game show. So I did what I do. You know, I get nervous, and I, as a defense mechanism, I make jokes and do those kinds of things. And I thought I was really funny and entertaining. And the director of the show was Dick Carson, Johnny's brother, who was a great game show director. And I didn't get the job. And I went backstage, and Dick said, you're not going to get this job. And I said, okay, why not? He said, because in game shows, the star is the game, not you. And I said, why didn't you tell me that before I went out and made a fool out of myself? But it really is. It's not about you being as amusing as you possibly can be. You just have to let the show be the star. So I learned that.
Take your moments.
Yes.
Take your shots.
Yeah. Anyway.
Wow. It's a dance.
It really is.
And yeah, you did show warm-ups, which is...
Orchestrate that, you know?
You did show warm-ups, sitcom warm-ups, which is, if you don't know what you're doing, you are in hell. Go ahead, tell me your warm-up stories.
Well, I had a lot of them, but that really, to me, was showbiz adjacent. I got a chance to do these warm-ups, and for the uninitiated, I was the guy that would stand in the audience and keep them entertained for 5 hours.
And let's all appreciate this man who does the best warm-up in the world.
Wow. Good night.
On a 22-minute show, because you stop, start, they want to reposition the cameras. More often than not, the actors want another shot at that scene, and it goes over and over and over. So I was doing sitcom warm-up early days of my career and got asked if I'd like to go to Vegas and do the warm-up for Circus of the Stars.
Yay.
Remember that show?
Wow. I can smell the elephant dung.
Well, you're not too far
okay.
off. You have no idea how poetic you are with that. And I thought, oh, it's Vegas. I'll get discovered. So I drive to Vegas, and people are standing in the heat of Las Vegas in this outdoor tent to come in and watch Merv ride an elephant. You know, the novelty wears off. And, you know, you can only get Nancy Walker on parallel bars for so long before they have to pull her off. So I'm doing warm-up, and I'm telling you, Louise, Fritz, it was 8 hours a day for 3 days.
Wow.
Because they'd have to, like, reassemble and re-weld the trapeze bar.
Sure.
And I'm, where are you from? What do you do? It was every Reader's Digest joke I had ever heard. And that's how I cut my teeth. And the warm-ups for me, between warm-ups and cruise ships, those were my, if we want to make an old reference here, those were my Catskills. That's where I learned.
Yeah, well, you're so fast that I'm sure that honed your skills. You know,
by
Jimmy Brogan, our friend Jimmy Brogan,
yeah.
who is a guy that started when we did, and he one of the successful warm-up guys. So he got laryngitis one time, and he did the Cheers warm-ups for like 4 years. And he got laryngitis and said, would you go do the Cheers warm-up at Paramount for me? For I can't talk. I said, oh.
They'll think you're me.
That'll be really cool. So I said, sure. And I went and did it. And it was a four-camera shoot, and it was film, and they had to stop every 10 minutes and reload. It was 5 hours, and I tanked. I've never worked that hard. Because I thought, well, I'll just go do my act. Everybody will think I'm hysterical. It'll be fantastic. No, it's not about that. It's juggling. It's you know, now they have T-shirt cannons, and they're throwing away $100 bills.
Well, you know, there are warm-ups that work that way. And then for me, I loved the challenge of trying to engage them. But I also realized, you know, the star of the show are those actors that everybody wants to see.
Yes.
My last run was with Betty White on Hot in Cleveland. I went back and did warm-up to be in the same atmosphere as Betty.
Yeah.
And
that was a funny
show. You
talk about
a great audience.
Yeah.
Do you have any Betty stories?
I've got, you know, where do I start? There's, you know, live audience, 300 people, cameras are rolling, awkward pause. Betty looks up and goes, you know, if no one's saying anything, it's probably my turn.
She was a sweetheart.
There's a bit where the director yells, "We need to go back." Betty, without missing a beat, goes, "How far, the pilot?" She had about 100 of these for being around 80 years, you know? It was unbelievable. So it was Betty White, Valerie Bertinelli, Jane Leaves, Wendy Malick. It was the happiest television set I'd ever seen.
Yeah, what a great cast.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
What about women hosting shows? You know, they haven't connected with the game show market yet.
Jane Lynch does.
Yeah. Kiki Palmer is doing Password now. And she does a good job.
So, Brooke Burns is going to be doing Tic-Tac-Toe.
Oh, good. It's changing. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. Do you remember Elaine Joyce hosting The Dating Game? You want to go back that far?
Oh, my gosh. No, I don't. But you're a little older than I am.
You know, you bring up the fact that co-hosting with women, Louise, I found this so compelling because they wanted to pair me up with a co-host. And you're thinking, well, I get that. It's daytime television. They want me to play off someone. But that relationship, that give and take, I don't know how long you two have known each other, but isn't that a dynamic that's ever changing, and you don't want to interrupt, but you want to get your part, right. And then you're interviewing a guest.
You can't manufacture chemistry.
It is delicate, and Fritz and I have hand signals in that he holds a finger up when he would like to speak, but I should probably get used to doing the same. But I'm more deferential. And so, and I want to make sure that, you know, he's comfortable with having had his opportunity to speak. So you're right. It's me and Fritz and our relationship, but then it's our relationship with the guests and making sure the guest is the one speaking the most often. So,
well, when Maddie and I did ABC, Mike and Maddie was the show that we did for ABC, and we didn't know each other. She was the last one in out of 85 women, and we sat down, and we had this great chemistry. She was on one of the last freedom flights out of Cuba. Her first language was Spanish. This was her first television show in English.
Oh, wow.
And it was almost a reverse Lucy Ricky. And if I just let Maddie be Maddie, we got magic. In fact, I see the lunch pails you have there.
I don't have a Mike
that
and Maddie.
That got me. Yeah, what are these lunch pails? They're classics, right?
They are classics. They only made metal lunch boxes for a finite period of time, so there is a specific number of them that were ever produced. But I love the art on them, and they.
Well, I'm going to show you something.
You have
this
an
is a toy.
Sketch.
Oh my god!
Yeah, but as you know, both of you, you get a fan base, and they want to connect, and they often do something nice for you. A fan reached out to Maddie and I, and I've had this since we went off the air, 1996, and made that.
Oh, that's great.
Wait, so what if
I came
in?
It's Mike and Maddie.
If I come in and shake it, it's still going to be there, right?
They took the juice out.
Whoa, that's
isn't
genius.
That something?
That's beautiful.
I know. I've had it ever since.
You know, before you did the show with Christina Ferrari.
Yeah. Another wonderful woman to work
with. I did
a
movie with her. I did a Perry Mason episode.
Wow. Go ahead and name drop.
This is all going to be a winding story, but you'll get a kick out of this because you worked with her and you understand what I'm talking about. So before she did your show, she was with Steve Edwards on Good Day LA or whatever.
Of course.
The hell. And she just sort of had her way on that show. And so I had to do this charity fashion show with Steve, and I'd never met him before, and I thought, well, this will ingratiate me to Steve because he'll realize what a warm and wonderful human being I am. So I went up to him and I said, you know, I don't know how much money you're making doing Eye on LA or whatever that is, but you earn your money every day by somehow being able to course correct this show, being able to steer it back toward the center line after she goes off to Jupiter somewhere. And he looks at me and he contemplates. He said, let me tell you something. That woman has seven times as many fans as I have. I'm so lucky to be on the show with her. All I want to do is not piss off Christina Ferrari. Mm. And I thought, wow. And he's right. Because women related to her because she wasn't perfect.
Oh. And she was so authentic and so honest. And I would just be in shock. We did Home and Family for 2 years.
Right.
And it was so wonderful just to take that ride. She was so real. We were on commercial and she had a cooking segment coming up, and Woody Fraser, who produced it, saw me look at him, and Woody was taking the cap off the pepper and then just putting it back on because he knew that she'd go use the pepper and then she'd yell and the thing would go, you know, off the rails because she would respond to that moment, yeah. You know.
She was funny.
Loved working with her.
And went through a lot in her personal life with Mr. DeLorean. Sure did. And oh, my goodness. Yeah.
I guess I'm not as up on my 90s pop culture.
Well, no, you're not quite. You're not quite old enough to understand.
No, I truly am. But
so you're doing this master class at Cal State LA, which is fantastic.
It's going to start in the fall. I'm going to be a little part of it. When they get to the hosting part, I'll jump in. Stuart Krasnow is going to teach it. Bob Bowden and Harry Friedman put it together.
Oh, wow.
And it's the first time a college, a university is offering a course on game shows and reality shows, what they are, how to produce them, how to get them on the air.
You're perfect at that.
Oh, yeah.
So say I wanted to get employment as a host tomorrow. What would be the
Not
top?
A chance.
Well, that's true. Mm. Except the AARP is going to do a talk show, and I'm going to be.
Oh.
But
well, don't you remember when we were all trying to get into this that there was a barrier to entry, and you had to know somebody, and there was a finite path. But now you don't need it. You could use your iPhone. You set up your studio. You go on YouTube.
True. Plus, now they have the Game Show Network, and they have a lot of product to fill, you know.
Does the Game Show Network, does it have new shows, or is it?
Game Show does? Yeah,
they do. Oh.
Yeah. They've got a great slate of game shows coming out. But if a buyer of television can go to social media and say, oh, they've got a million followers, let's harvest them and give them a chance. So it's just the new way of business. You adapt. As my friend Ross, you know Ross Schaefer. Ross has got a great line about the business. He goes, if you don't like change, you're going to probably hate extinction.
Oh, wow.
And you know, here's another story. This happened a couple of years ago, and it just sticks in my head. We're reminiscing about showbiz. There's a great little restaurant bar down here in Long Beach, Belmont Shore. And I'm sitting there one night, and they have live music. And in fact, it's just one guy at a piano on a Thursday night. And maybe there's 15 people in there. And he'd finish a song, and I'd give him a little something, right? I wanted to get the crowd going. You know how it is as performers. We want them to feel good. And nothing's happening, and it's song after song. And finally, he takes his break, and he comes up to the bar and says, hey, buy you a drink? I go, yeah. He goes, thanks for trying to make that happen. I said, you're welcome. He goes, let me tell you my favorite showbiz story. He was playing a bar downtown L.A., and it was the same response. It's just crickets. And finally, he finishes one song, and he hears, and he looks up. And it was a woman taking a cigarette out of a pack. Wow. Doesn't that sum up showbiz?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, yes. Pretty much. I mean, I think we have to be our own biggest fan.
You have to have some confidence. I grew up in a classroom where I would try to get a laugh, and my parents were teachers, and I try to find that balance of getting a laugh and not getting in trouble. And again, as you guys know, I'm just wired that way. I love it.
You do a lot of corporate speaking. What do you talk about when you speak in front of
on the corporate street?
Yeah.
You know, the corporate world, you've got sales specifically or managers. It's just a relationship business. And if you're a CEO and want to host your next meeting, there are skill sets that hosts have that are universal. Listen to learn, not respond. Let somebody else have a moment. Kind of comes back to the same stuff. Ask somebody about themselves, and you've injected them with a drug so powerful they'll want to come back for more. A salesperson that learns that will be better than any salesperson that hasn't, you know, come to realize that it's about this. Mm-hmm. It's about us.
When you teach and when you coach, are you teaching what you wish someone had taught you, or are you just teaching what you've come to know along the way about success and life?
That's a great question. I've never been asked that. You know, you learn by doing, and I've learned what to do and what not to do. So I start there, and again, these basic principles of making it about them, making something concise in this world that requires such a quick turnover, being brief. Blaise Pascal was this great philosopher who had a quote, if I had more time, I would have written a shorter letter.
Yeah.
Isn't that a great line?
No, it
about
is. If you're a writer,
being brief.
You understand it immediately if you're a writer, because you have to take away everything that isn't the thought.
That's right. I liken this to home remodeling. I've flipped a bunch of homes over the years, and I started to do some of my own work, which was a mistake initially. And I was putting up drywall, and drywall goes up, and there's a little bevel in between where you put the mud, and you slap that compound on there, and then you smooth it out and sand it, and in theory, you won't see a seam. Well, I wanted to make sure there was no seam, so I put a lot of mud on there, which meant on the other side, I had a lot of sanding to do. If you watch a drywaller do what they do, there's so little mud there. It's the perfect amount, so there's very little sanding, and it's this perfect finish. I liken that to a conversation. Take out all of the joint compound. Take out all the conversational mud. Pare it down to what you need, and you'll be much more effective as a communicator.
But you also teach about excellence. And at first, the word seemed a little harsh for me because I worry about people who will never be able to believe that they've done well, that they will obsess about that term excellence. But define excellence for us the way that you see it.
I like saying, be a master sommelier, not a waiter. If you go to a restaurant and you order a bottle of wine from a sommelier, you have a lot of choices because this sommelier knows what they're doing. It's not, we have a white and we have a red and then here's a Tanqueray gin. They know so much, they can tell you this story of the wine. The person with the best story wins, I like saying. So if you're going to be excellent, if you're going to be great at what you do, be so well-informed, be so good at the fundamentals. The movie Psalm, which won a documentary almost 10 years ago about people that studied to become sommeliers. Did you see that?
No.
It's a wonderful documentary. And to pass, to become a master sommelier, there's like 25 things you need to know. The side of the hill the grape was from, the terroir, the soil. But one of the finals in the sommelier test is they put six glasses of wine in front of you, three red, three white. And you got to take a sip and identify these 25 things. And you got to do it in 25 minutes, and you have to do it blindfolded. So I say to these corporate leaders, imagine being that good at what you do, that you're so steeped in knowledge, you can't be thrown by the competition. That's kind of the corporate stuff.
Mm-hmm. You also had an experience very similar to mine where you were trying to nudge your career in one direction.
What was that?
No, then it took a turn. Is that not true that you started out?
Oh, you mean by nudging, not getting called?
Yeah. but you.
Well, I really thought I was going to take over The Price is Right. There were a handful of us doing that on the road, having a blast. And then ultimately they went with Drew Carey, which clearly was a good choice. But I realized the skill set that we all have is not something that's dedicated to hosting TVs and game shows. You can do so much more. So I got into the corporate world and take these similar themes because they're universal. I think the youth, this is why I'm excited with this college group. I think 18 to 25-year-olds would benefit from the art of conversation because they're stuck with this.
Yeah.
And they don't have to put a sentence together, but
no.
I think we can get them there.
No.
That's a good point. They're better at many things, but they are not as good at certain key things that, you know, we always kind of look up to kids as being native technology users, but maybe they need to look at us as native conversationalists.
Yeah. And don't you find it fascinating if you go to a restaurant or you meet a young person who has that skill set, that they have this gift to communicate, that they stand out over so many others. I think that's their ace in the hole as they move forward.
Our intern Garrett is a good example of that. He's 16 years old, and he could walk into a room, any number of adults, and really hold his own.
Who's that?
Our intern Garrett, 16.
Good for you, Garrett. Stick with it.
Yeah.
It's because he has a lot of interests. So I think if you're someone that's interested in many things, you meet and you're young, you realize that I could have a conversation with somebody or I could just keep scrolling. But my parents know people who know things, and he seems interested in everybody. And I think that's critical.
That's a gift, because if you're going to be good at anything, if you want to be in this business, great. But you have to show interest in someone else. Mm-hmm. It's not about you. It's about them. And if people can get that concept down, there's no stopping them. And then, you know, you mentioned that this pivot maybe in the career. Gary Kasparov, a grandmaster chess champion, calls it the gravity of past success. We reach a certain level and we stop doing what got us there. I think we need to keep trying. We got to keep moving. Sometimes it'll get right back to where we want it to be. You know, here I am talking to you. This I love. This to me is showbiz. Mm-hmm. So it's everything else I've done helped me get to this, you know, media path podcast.
Yeah.
Well, I was reading your website and you say that excellence oriented people, this is back to excellence because I'm kind of captivated by that term because it's a very potent term and I don't want it to intimidate. So you say that excellence oriented people are happier because they are accountable. Or is it possible that being accountable is what makes them excellent? Taking responsibility means that you're not pointing fingers, you're finding solutions and you're making corrections.
Well, you've hit it on all points. You're also, there's a self-worth there. And people will forgive almost anything. If you are accountable, if you do acknowledge the mistake, people will follow leaders that have that... They want you to succeed. The executives that I've met that have run successful companies are rooting for their employees,
mm-hmm.
and they're making them accountable. And there's an old parable about the two lumberjacks that go out and they made a wager to see who could cut down the most trees. And the rules were you had to start at the same time, finish at the same time. In fact, you had to use the same kind of axe. So they go off, they get a week to do it. And during that week, one of the lumberjacks notices the other guy takes off at noon every day, goes, comes back an hour later. At the end of the week, they add up all the wood that's been cut. And the guy that left every day for an hour cut down more trees. And the other guy says, I don't know how you do this. We start at the same time. We finish at the same time. We had the same kind of axe. And you go away for lunch for an hour and you come back. And you won. He goes, yeah. He goes, yeah, I did win. He goes, but I didn't go to lunch. I went home and sharpened my axe.
Well,
Isn't that a message about continuing to work?
Yes. And also about being thorough in how you approach your task. What is involved? What is required?
Well, you know, I'm into classic cars, and I bought an old Mustang, a 66 Mustang, and I found out who to take it to do the restoration. And I asked the guy, since I got a little free time, since I don't have a 40-year career doing weather, I said, is there something I can do to play along? Can I inhale some chemicals and help you sand a nesting chair? So every day I would go hang out when I was in town and just be his sensei. And when it came to lunch... I said, can I get you something? He goes, yeah. And he had his favorite place. It was Taco Bell, and he just wanted two tacos and a Diet Coke. So I went, and I got him hooked up. I got him the Grande, and I got a big Coke and fries. And he said, thank you. And he wasn't effusive about it. He just said, oh, great, thanks. So that's odd. I kind of came out of pocket for this. The next day, same thing, noon, I start to go, and he goes, by the way, two tacos, Diet Coke. This guy was so... specific in his restoration, in his life. He was the guy that as he was putting screws in the dash, he would turn the Phillips head so they all lined up.
Oh my.
Wow.
And this guy
it's called OCD.
Has a restoration shop in Stanton, California. You can't find it. There's no address. And he is turning away business because he's excellent at what he does. He is so good at the fundamentals. He's so specific that people beat a path to his door. I was one of them. I had to find him. I said, where's your sign? He goes, I don't need a sign. I said, okay.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he's too perfect. And I made a whole career out of showing my ability to not be.
I was impressed.
Yeah.
I thought I'd get a deal with more tacos, and he still charged me what he charged me.
That's interesting. It's like human nature to go above, and sometimes that's not what other people are receptive to. It throws them off, you know, because they're creatures.
Oh, you mean me doing that for him?
Yeah, like he's a creature of habit, and that was a distraction, and it was like, uh-oh, now I don't know how much to eat. I'm confused.
Yeah, it was just his routine, and he was so specific, and he was such a great craftsman that this was just part. I've known him now for 15 years, and it hasn't changed. This is what he does. Mm-hmm. He used to have a lot of employees. It's just him. He does these one-offs, and he stays busy. Be great at what you do, and people will be the path to your door.
I love it.
Who's the greatest game show host of all time?
Ooh, that's a good question.
And you can't consider yourself in the mix.
Did I come off as the guy that would throw my name in the hat?
No.
I think you'd have to say Bob Barker for me, because I thought he made the show and the show made him. But he had the instincts of letting a moment breathe, like Vin Scully would let a home run play out. I think Bob never made the show about him. I think Carson was the best as a host.
I agree there.
You know, when I got that show, it was called Matchmates. It was NBC. It was 30 years ago. And my first drive on a lot was at NBC, and it was six spots down from Carson. And do you remember his white Corvette, Fritz?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember his license plate?
No, I can't remember that.
360 guy.
Oh, my.
All-around guy.
Oh, that's great. And he used to drive a DeLorean. To the first DeLorean I ever saw, he owned it, brought it to work.
Oh, right. He didn't do well on that exchange.
No.
But anyway, we shoot this pilot, and they just pulled me off the boat. I am so green behind the ears, but I get this pilot, and we finish it. And 10 feet across, they're shooting The Tonight Show. This is 1989, maybe 90. Then security's not much there. So I crack the door, and they're in the middle of The Tonight Show. I go in and sit down. I sit down behind the curtain, and I'm sitting next to Gregory Peck.
What?
And he goes, "Hello, Michael." Mr. Peck. The show ends. Carson comes around, and I'm standing there with Gregory Peck and Carson, and Johnny goes, I understand that you're doing a little show next door. Good luck with that. And then off he goes. That's my introduction to show business.
That's all you needed. Yeah.
Ends. With a fitting postscript. The show did not get picked up. It was my first pilot, and it introduced me to, this is how it's going to be. You get a pilot, then what? Gets on the air? Does it stay on the air? Do people follow you?
Yeah.
It was a lesson learned.
I was being considered to host a show that Bill Cullen used to host called Hot Potato. Meryl Heater was the producer of it, right?
Meryl Heater.
So I went through the whole process. They loved me. I even got to the point where they built the set. It was an older show that took some time off because Bill Cullen was not well. And so I got to the point where I had my outfit picked off, and I said, maybe I better go ask my boss if this is okay. You know, the Channel 4, because I had an NBC contract, and he wouldn't let me do it.
Oh, your boss wouldn't let you do it?
No. And
why?
Because Pat Sajak, when he did, he was the weatherman, two good weather guys before me.
Sure.
Hung him out to dry. The older general manager came to Pat about halfway through his first tenure at Wheel and said, you know, we think you're stretching yourself a little thin, Pat. You're going to have to decide whether you want to do the weather or you want to do the game. And they were very sort of soft about it because they figured the news is the only show that never gets canceled. He's going to go with a weather job. And he said, okay, I'll take the game. And he's retiring.
I mean, how about you? Did you logically know that this was a good spot to be in, or did you want to get out there and tour and host game shows and talk shows?
I was excited about it. They made me feel very comfortable, and they trained me. Again, I was an inexperienced person in the games, and I had to be taught. And I liked it. I loved the idea. And I thought, you know, it was like all the other ones are going to sign you to a 7-year contract and you know, all that deal. But no, it was exciting for me. It was show business. But my boss knocked my legs out from under me. He said, no, Pat Sajak was the last guy to do that to us, and you're not going to do it to us again.
But you know, Fritz knows how to let the weather be the star.
Let me shower you with a couple compliments here.
Please.
Watching you, I was an NBC guy, maybe because I had my first little experience with them, but it was John Chuback, Trisha Toyota, John Beard. It was you, of course, Fred. But people like us trying to make it in the business, starting out to do stand-up, then we see Fritz. And Fritz is this perfect combination of getting the story told, and you would be funny unless there was a tree down in Woodland Hills, and then you'd shift the tone.
That's right.
But I thought, well, this is how you do it. This Fritz is doing what we want to do. He's
well,
on the air every
I always
day.
Explain my job as being the palate cleanser between the tragedy and the sports.
Yeah, you're the sorbet of afternoon evening news. Yeah,
but now,
but you did it so well,
oh,
and you had
well,
that
I
humor.
I appreciate that. I had so
that
much
kept
fun.
It,
yes,
I don't know.
And it's a beautiful blend. And now, in addition to being a podcast host, he's got what do you call it?
A residency.
A residency, yeah. Sometimes I don't remember all the words that I had in
my head.
Well,
it's a very formal word.
The residency at the anyway, you describe it, because he's
I have a residency at the El Portal Theater in North Hollywood. You know, they have a smaller theater, the Marilyn Monroe Forum, which is 100 seats. It's a smaller theater.
You mean they've kicked you out where you're living and you're living now in
I'm
a theater?
Living in there.
He has
in
a residency.
A tent. And
what are you doing there?
I'm doing stand-up. I have my own show. Wendy Liebman opens the show for me, and we've been there since October. We've been extended twice, and now we're going to be there through August. So I'm having a great time. And there are no maps involved. And nobody says, explain to me the atmospheric river. I just say, bite me. Look on your phone and leave me alone. Yeah. This is about stand-up.
The real Fritz comes out?
Yeah. He's.
I'm having a good time.
It's yeah. So
are you where are you grabbing your material? Are you trying?
I'm
you
an observation.
Homage to what we grew up with. Are you doing what the kids are doing?
No, I'm not doing what the kids are doing. I have I found that I do better if I'm age appropriate. I play to my demographic, which is old people and their parents, and I try to work relatively not. I mean, I do edgy stuff, but I don't use a lot of profanity. And I had I have a special airing on Tubi now. And the way we were able to pitch it was there are dozens of great stand-up shows on Netflix and Amazon Prime that take into consideration young people. And, you know, God bless Dave Chappelle. He's a brilliant guy. But there are people, you know, boomers and older that get a little uncomfortable with the topics and with the language. And I thought, I'll do a show. And the name of the show is Unassisted Living. And so it's about getting older. And they said, we want that because they're sort of an underserved demographic in the entertainment business.
Right.
I said, exactly.
Yes, and
you're
it's
right.
And maybe soon you could recommend him so he can teach a class in how to transition from weatherman to residency.
To female weatherman.
I think he's done it successfully. Was that tough saying goodbye after 40, or were you hanging on going, hey, give me one more year?
I tell I actually retired later than I wanted to, but then the pandemic and the lockdown started, and we started doing shows from home with these video packs, and my boss asked me to hang around for a couple of months to sort of smooth that transition.
Sure.
No, I retired at precisely the right moment. I tell people that even if you love what you do, 40 years is long enough. You know, it's just long enough.
Yeah, it's pretty rare to get that kind of run, right?
Oh, my God. I'm so fortunate.
When we did Mike and Maddie, we did 2 years. That's 535 episodes, because like you, we're on every day. And this just came up, and it was sort of a sore spot. When Mike and Maddie premiered, it premiered at the same time as the O.J. trial.
Oh, Lord have mercy. That's more bad luck.
So we would be on, we'd be off. And then hosting game shows, as you know, you'd shoot 6 or 7 a day. You'd get them done in 2 months and then sit back and see if they would be picked up. And then you'd go do other fun things.
Did you take a shot at the wheel job when it was obvious that, he was going to retire?
Did I take a shot at it, or was I asked?
Were you asked? Were you part of the mix? No? Okay.
No. No, Ryan Seacrest had that thing locked up, I think, pretty well.
Uh-huh.
It's something he wanted to do, and how do you say no to Ryan?
No.
Well, is there anything else that you would like to bring to our attention? You have a website.
Two books!
No, he's got like 4 books, I think.
Yeah.
He's
it's not,
you've been busy, Mike.
It's not important.
absolutely necessary.
They're self-printed, just
and
everybody
coloring
down.
Your way to success, which is one of the great titles.
Well,
of the
you
book.
Know what? I am proud of that.
That's a great title.
I'm not going to bend down because I'll be age appropriate.
Does it come with crayons? What happens?
Oh, what the hell? It doesn't come with crayons. Do you remember the coloring book craze like in 2015?
Oh, yeah.
You right? So I hooked my cart just as it was over. And what people were doing is they were coloring and they found it, you know,
soothing,
meditative,
yes.
And it was a blast. So I took 52 of the smartest things anyone's ever said, and I put that in a coloring book and had an illustrator draw what that quote is. And as you color, you discover the quote.
Ooh.
And then behind the quote is a worksheet. There's a little Oprah Super Sunday.
Wow.
How do I apply this to my life?
Oh, how wonderful.
And I've sold it on the corporate circuit and such. But, you know, these quotes that are evergreen, like, it's okay to look back, but a waste of time to stare.
Oh, that's good.
Things, but they've stuck with me. And so this great illustrator came up with that. There are examples of this on my website, and the book is around. But
are you doing corporate stuff? Are you still doing corporate speaking?
Now and then. Mm-hmm. You know, like you, Fritz, I handled my money well. I don't know what that means. Oh, I invested in lunchboxes. I'll go out and do a corporate here and there. The teaching will be a blast. I can't wait to do that.
Oh, you'll be excellent.
And then outside of that, it's everything in the brochure. I play tennis. I got a boat. I pick my fun career opportunities, which after doing it for 30, 40 years, you kind of get to do that now.
Well, you're very talented and very entertaining and very funny, and I'm happy that you would spend a little time with us today, my friend.
Yes,
I'm happy you asked. I just caught Richard Jenny last week, and this is the place you...
If you caught Richard Jenny, you're a spiritual man. You mean Kevin Pollak.
You're a cultural touchstone, are you not? You're a dictator of taste.
No,
you're a conversation driver. Am I right? Is that what
true.
You said?
Could you make your next coloring book phrases that Fritz is?
That's right.
I should start with Fritz said it would be like this. Wouldn't that be the one we start with?
There you go.
All right, here come your closing credits. Thanks for coming along down the Media Path. We would love to continue this conversation with you on Instagram and Twitter, where we are at Media Path Pod, and on Facebook, where our show page is Media Path Podcast, and our Facebook group is Media Path with Fritz and Wheezy Podcast Community. And we are a video podcast on YouTube. You get to watch us and laugh at our outfits and then hopefully subscribe. Our YouTubes are full of additional visual treats that will surprise and delight you. Find us at Media Path Podcast on YouTube. Write to us at mediapathpodcast@gmail.com. Tell us what you've been watching, reading, and loving. If you enjoy our show, please give us a nice rating wherever you get your podcasts and share our social media posts so that your friends can learn about your excellent taste in podcasts. Our website is mediapathpodcast.com. Here you can find interesting episodes you may have missed. We also have a fun and sassy newsletter loaded with bonus content about our guests. All of the newsletters are right there for you to enjoy on our website, and you can sign up to get your newsletter sent directly into your inbox, just one per week, because we do understand healthy boundaries. We want to thank our guests, Jasmine Crockett and Michael Berger. Our team includes producer Dina Friedman, John Maddox, Bill Filipiak, Mason Brown, Garrett Arch, Jordan Reyes, and you. Our theme music is by me and John Maddox. I am Louise Planker, here with Fritz Coleman and Michael Berger. Be well and wise, and we will see you along the media path.